This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Cindy Sheehan leaves the peace movement and, in a way, kicks the Democratic Party upside the backside or upside the head on the way out. We'll be talking about that in the second hour of the program and what the Republican plan for 2008 is. I have an op-ed I wrote today. It's up on commondreams.org. The Republican plan for 2008 begins today, and it does. We will be getting into that and much more of the news of the day. Greg Callist will be here with us in the third hour of the program, as well as Frank Hurd talking about how the federal government may be on the verge of making criminal many of the vitamins and health foods that many of us think keep us alive. So, lots coming up. Right now, Neil McCluskey is with us. He's with the Cato Institute, cato.org, C-A-T-O.org, the website. He's a policy analyst with the Cato Institute's Center for Educational Freedom and the author of a new book, Feds in the Classroom, How Big Government Corrupts, Cripples, and Compromises American Education. Neil McCluskey, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Neil. Glad to have you here. The two quick thoughts here. I spent a fair amount of time with your book, and one of the things that I don't want to say offended me, but I think, frankly, weakened your argument, and so I'm going to toss this at you and give you a chance to rebut it, is where repeatedly throughout the book you take on progressives. You talk about the progressive reforms of the 1880s, telling people that... I should have folded the page. I don't have it right in front of me. That now that we're going to teach children what their role in society should be, the way progressives do. And that has never been the progressive position. The progressive position going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson has been that people should have the maximum amount of freedom to decide what to do. You read the writings of most conservatives, and they talk about the need for class and order in societies. It's the reason Jefferson wanted the University of Virginia to be free was so that people could become anything they wanted. The reason that Ronald Reagan wanted to do away with that was because he was concerned that too many kids were going to college for free and becoming agitators and troublemakers. And he said so.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, there are different kinds of progressives, and I'm talking about pedagogical progressives who, you know, they support such things as whole language instruction and whole language reading instruction and constructed knowledge and sort of letting kids explore to learn.
Experiments in the evolution of education, weren't they?
Well, they were, except the problem was parents and kids could not get out of those experiments because they had to go to these public schools. And so what I was talking about was forcing people to be part of these experiments was wrong because those experiments did not work for many kids. But I also talk about the flip side, which is now with No Child Left Behind, we're having sort of the backlash where sort of pedagogical and political conservatives are trying to impose their way of teaching on people because they dislike progressivism so much. What I'm calling for is have true freedom and let parents choose the instruction that works best for their child rather than having any type of instruction forced on everyone.
Yeah, and perhaps instead of pedagogical, we should use the word educational, because I have a feeling some listeners may think that we're talking about something that's illegal. Another, you know, how life is here in America. But this is where you and I have some small measure of agreement and probably a very large measure of disagreement. I believe in school choice in as much as I think that parents should be allowed to send their children pretty much to any school they want. And I'm even a little uncertain about absolute mandatory education, the mandating of education. I mean, you go back, I didn't see this in your book, but I wrote about it in one of my books. You go back to the Spinnenschule in the 1700s in Austria, Queen Maria Antonia or whatever her name was, who started this idea of kids would get a half a day of school if they worked in the spinneries for a half a day, you know, making clothing. and then Horace Mann in the 1880s in Boston telling the Protestants who had become the minority, yet they still controlled the legislature through the secret society known as the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, the Know-Nothing Legislature of the 1880s, that they could break the back of the growing Catholic movement by forcing these Catholic kids into public schools and basically breaking up the insularity of their communities. And it was embraced, and there were some riots and protests and parents who went to jail. And so, you know, I have some concerns about absolutely mandatory public education. On the other hand, there is a public good there. You know, it's sort of like the safety belt, seatbelt laws. But it seems to me, in reading your book, Neil McCluskey, that you and the Cato Institute are taking the position that when I say school choice, what I mean is, you know, if you've got four or five public schools in the community, you can send your kid to whichever one you want, or a private school if you can afford it, or you can homeschool if you can afford it, or you choose to. And frankly, I've done all three. And with our three kids, one went to public school, one went to private school, one was homeschooled. And I'm on the board of a private school up in New Hampshire, a nonprofit school, I will add. But it seems to me that what you're advocating is the use of federal taxpayer dollars for the essentially support of religious and for-profit schools through voucher systems. And that I strongly oppose.
Well, I strongly oppose any federal voucher program. In fact, I say quite clearly in the book, the federal government needs to get out of education completely. I do, though, think there need to be either voucher or tax credit programs or some sort of program at the state and local level that allows parents to choose whatever school best educates their children. And my concern about making that only public school choices, you're essentially saying to one provider, the public school system, you provide all the options. Well, that really ends up being no option at all if your choice is either, you know, Coke or New Coke, rather than getting to choose Pepsi or Sprite or any other, you know, any of the myriad other soft drinks we have. And so if for choice to really be meaningful and to not oppress people who might not think the way that everyone else does or have the same values as everyone else, they have to be able to choose a variety of schools, and they have to be able to do it without being penalized by having to pay for a single system of public schooling that, you know, might provide a few options that they don't like, and then pay on top of it for homeschooling.
Yeah, here's a couple of problems with that, though. First of all, if you have, and I realize you're making an argument based on the Constitution, on the Ninth Amendment, that, you know, the states have the power and education is not mentioned in the Constitution, although you could argue that it falls into the preamble under the General Welfare Clause. And you take on that argument in your book, but you disagree, you know, with the position that I would take on it. But here's the problem. Number one, if there isn't at least some participation, and we're both opponents of No Child Left Behind, let me put that on the table, perhaps for different reasons, in some cases for very similar reasons. But if you take the federal government out of the equation altogether, what you end up with is poorer states having poorer schools than richer states. If you take state, and when you go into vouchers, what you end up with is that public schools become dumping grounds for the students that no private school will take, or whose parents can't get, you know, are so incompetent in terms of, you know, their involvement with the education of the children, for a whole variety of reasons, ranging from socioeconomic to simply there are some mentally ill parents out there, to they're working five jobs, right, or it's a single parent working three jobs. That the public schools become more and more the dumping ground. It's the destruction of the public schools, number one. And secondly, most of the voucher systems that I've seen, most of the voucher programs that I've seen, typically pay $2,000, $3,000, sometimes $4,000, sometimes as much as $5,000 in proposals. I've never seen one actually put into law that was more than $2,500, where the average cost of a public school education in the United States is $5,600 a year. The last time I looked, in the neighborhood of between $5,000 and $6,000 a year. And most private schools start at around $7,000 to $9,000 a year and go up from there into the 50s.
Well, let me take the second part first about the funding. Actually, the Census Bureau just came out the end of last week with the latest funding amounts, and it's actually up to now $10,000-some nationwide for the average that's spent per pupil. And so
right, so you're not going to see any kind of voucher program that offers $10,000.
Well, Right now, actually, the D.C. voucher program offers about 7,500. So we're getting closer, but you're right.
So that's only useful to the upper middle class who are looking for a $7,500 deduction. It's not useful to some poor person who can't dig 2,500 bucks out of their pocket.
Oh, well, except the D.C. voucher program is geared exclusively to low-income parents, and it's way oversubscribed, as we see for most school choice that's focused at low-income people. There are huge wait lists. You look at charter schools. You can look at school choice programs.
But charter schools get federal funding or get government funding.
Well, they do, but they are another option that is more free, certainly, than traditional public schools.
Yeah. Isn't the bottom line, Neil, and we just have, well, we're out of time here. We'll have to revisit this at more length in the future. Neil McCluskey, Feds in the Classroom is the book, How Big Government Corrupts, Cripples, and Compromises American Education. You can read about it over at Cato, cato.org. Neil, thanks for dropping in today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's 16 minutes past the hour in the Tom Hartman radio program. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
See, what we're seeing here is the beginning again. Actually, it's been an ongoing process largely ever since Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981. Arguably, it goes even back before that. Reagan dismantling the access of middle-income people and working people to the California public education system, higher education, college system. I strongly being of the opinion that college education should be free to everyone in the United States, just like secondary education and primary education. That if somebody wants to go to a college or university, at least a state school, that there should be no charge if they can demonstrate that they have the ability to perform. I absolutely agree with Thomas Jefferson in that regard. But what we're seeing now is the assault on education. And there's a couple of agendas at work here specifically speaking of our previous guest, but just broadly, there's a couple of agendas at work here that you're going to be seeing played out with increasing aggressiveness over the next few years. And there's a reason why. The reason why is because it limits social mobility, which is one of the conservative goals, is to reduce social mobility, to keep people in their class, to keep them in a situation where they don't rise up and say, hey, wait a minute, what about us? We want our rights. The two periods of the greatest strength of the American middle class, the 1770s and the 1970s, were also the two periods of the greatest social instability. And liberals looked at that social instability, liberals like Thomas Jefferson, and said, these are the birth pains. This is a transition in society that's a desirable and healthy thing. And conservatives looked at that social instability and said, oh, my God, society's melting down. This is a bad thing. And so we have this war on education. And it's all about getting private, for-profit corporations into the education business more and more aggressively. No Child Left Behind turned a $400 million a year testing industry into a $2 billion a year testing industry. It's probably more than that now. I mean, this was back when Jim Jeffords was opposing it. Janie Bowman, a friend of mine, wrote this. I want to just share this with you very quickly. Yesterday's child was born in the 1800s. As a young boy, he was considered medically fragile. Every respiratory illness known to mankind in that age seemed to seize him. Even though yesterday's child spent many of his early years ill, this did not stop his insatiable curiosity and boyish escapades. Today's child would be described as just being a boy. Yesterday's child often found himself in risky life and death situations. One time around the age of 5, he nearly drowned in a canal. Later, he almost smothered as he sank into the depths of a grain elevator. Today's child would be described as having no common sense. He was found asleep in the barn in a nest he'd constructed, laying on top of chicken and goose eggs he was trying to hatch. Today's child would be called weird, eccentric. Get off those eggs, you'll crack them. Yesterday's child drove his parents to exhaustion by his persistent questioning of the world around him, determined to know the whys, what fors, and whatabouts of his world. Today's child is searching for someone to ask those questions of. Yesterday's child, with no malice of forethought, but only out of the intense curiosity of an inquisitive mind, set his father's barn on fire by accident. For this, he was publicly thrashed by his father, who tried to instill in him the serious consequences of his actions. Today's child would be called a juvenile delinquent. After only 3 months of formal education, yesterday's child walked out of his school in a fit of rage. Running home, he could hear the words of his schoolmaster echoing in his mind, "You are stupid, you are stubborn, you are difficult." Thus, at the tender age of 8, yesterday's child refused to return to school. The next day, his mother gave the schoolmaster a piece of her mind and withdrew her son from school, and from that day onward, she became his teacher. Today's child would be called a problem child, a bad boy, oppositional. Today's mother would be told she was highly excitable and coddling her child. She'd be encouraged by all the experts to force her child to return to school. He's just got to learn to adjust or take some Ritalin. Yesterday's child went swimming with a friend in a nearby creek. When the friend didn't surface for air, the child waited for what seemed like forever. As darkness fell, he, in his own unique 5-year logic, concluded it was time to go home. As the time was trying to piece together the disappearance and drowning, he tried to explain how he waited for what seemed like forever. Today's child would be treated for conduct disorder and would undoubtedly find himself one step away from the juvenile justice system. One day he attached wires to the tails of two cats and energetically rubbed their fur. This experiment in static electricity went astray when he was brutally clawed. Today he'd be diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, pervasive developmental disorder, or some other disorder. His mother complained about the life-threatening condition of his bedroom, you know, fearing for the safety of her family and any others who happened to venture into the family home. Today's child, his laboratory and all these other things. Today's child would be, again, just said, you know, there's something wrong with this kid. Give him some drugs. Yesterday's child, his name, Thomas Alva Edison, this young man I've been describing to you, that Janie Bowman wrote so eloquently about. We really do need an educational system in the United States that meets the needs of all of our kids. But it's not going to be provided by corporations who are trying to provide a more and more homogenous form of education. It's going to be provided by an educational system that actually and truly does meet the needs of kids and has a large element of local control, but has enough funding from all across the United States that poor communities don't end up with poor schools. It's pretty straightforward stuff. 27 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Baby, do you understand me now? Sometimes I feel a little mad. But don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad.
So this conservative war on public education has a very, very clear and, frankly, once you get it, easily understood ideology behind it. First of all, public education in this country at the moment is provided mostly by unionized teachers. Back in the 80s, when the great purge of the civics classes and the civics textbooks began under the Reagan administration, to take out the history of the Wobblies and the IWW, which was the Wobblies, the progressive movement, you know, who was Joe Hill, the history of the labor movement, strip all that stuff out of the textbooks. When that began, because, oh my God, those people are socialists, you know, we can't have them, you know, teaching our kids. What? Can't do that. That was the beginning, but they're union members. Can't have that. But there's a very clear ideological basis for this whole thing, and that very clear ideological basis has to do with this simple notion that corporations can always do things better than government, and that the commons, and public education in the United States is considered part of the commons until you get to college, where it's not, except it is, except it's not. I mean, we give all these grants and funding to state universities, except kids can't afford to go to them. But nonetheless, that private corporations should be running the commons, and, you know, we'll just make it a for-profit deal. Let Neil Bush make a whole lot of money on this, and And that's the end of that, right? And I think, frankly, it's a tragedy. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee, listening to WSMB. Hey, Bob.
Hello, Tom. Tom, your guest this morning said that the federal government should be out of education altogether. And you and I had a disagreement about a month ago when we spoke about advertising for drugs. Now, I taught school from 1973 until 2003, both in the public schools and private schools. My feeling is that the federal government should perhaps try and equalize funding, but however should not be determining curriculum or testing, but in fact should be in education.
Yeah, Bob, I agree with your position. I mean, that was my point, I am opposed to No Child Left Behind because I am opposed to the idea of schools as assembly lines, basically, and children as items on an assembly line where we try to produce a standard product, a standardized product, which has, you know, been much of the philosophy behind education ever since Horace Mann. On the other hand, So I think that, you know, some strong level of local control, community control, state input, all those things are necessary. On the other hand, there are poor communities that can't afford to fund their schools well, and poor states that can't fund their schools well. And I think that the federal government should play a role in equalizing the availability of that funding.
But in addition, I have an additional idea. Education, as apart from the schools themselves, the FDA has tremendous amount of information about drugs, side effects, and such. The Environmental Protection Agency has a tremendous amount of knowledge, information about toxic chemicals, locations of dead zones. There's a lot of knowledge in the CDC and such places that the federal government should be disseminating in our society. I think that is the role for the federal government in education and the general education of the people in the society.
Well, that's different from public education. That's different from the education of kids.
But,
and yeah, I don't disagree that regulatory agencies and whatnot should be making their information public.
Surely, but it might be a proper role for a federal education department.
Interesting. Interesting concept. Thank you, Bob. It's something I hadn't considered. Bill in New Haven, Connecticut. Hey, Bill.
How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to comment that this is not the first assault. Sorry about that. This is not the first assault on our education system. The first happened back in the 30s when they basically revamped our teaching reading methods to the Dick and Jane thing instead of phonetics.
Right.
And illiteracy rates proceeded to plummet. From back in the late 1800s, it was up in the high 90s.
Now, yeah, although I'm not sure that had to do with teaching phonics. First of all, back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, when you say literacy was in the high 90%, you're looking at exclusively whites, and I mean, you know, the statistics are very, very, very biased.
That's true, but I read a quote from the head of the National Education Association in the 30s, who said, "We are trying to do with our education system what dictators in Europe are attempting to do with force."
Yeah. Yeah, so, I get the point, Bill, and frankly, there are people, you know, the David Horowitzes who are running around who want to take control of our college campuses and take control of our schools, and the anti-evolution people who want to teach, biblical creationism in our schools and that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, there are people who basically want to shove a particular agenda down people's throats. I think that our schools need to be more Socratic in their teaching, more interactive, more highly interactive. These are not things that lend themselves to standardized testing. That's the problem with standardized testing, is it turns every kid into a little commodity. It's like an assembly line, and the shoe that doesn't quite fit or isn't just the absolute gets pushed off the assembly line bucket, into a waste bucket that we refer to as special education and shunted off to the side. Which is not to say that there aren't a lot of kids who need special education programs. They do. And they're very real. I mean, that's the basis of the private school in New Hampshire that I'm on the board of. It's a school for kids with attention deficit disorder. It's called Hunter School. But nonetheless, The idea that they that anybody should be segregated out and said, oh, you're not a standard product, and we're only trying to produce a standardized product, and we're only going to teach to a particular learning style, and we're only going to teach it a particular way, I think is pretty dysfunctional. And the more it becomes federalized at the level of what's happening in the schools, as opposed to simply helping fund the schools so that they can exist, the more it becomes federalized, the more subject it is to the kind of manipulation we've seen, like recently where Karl Rove is going into virtually every department in the executive branch, which would include the education department, and doing PowerPoint presentations on how they can use that department to ensure a Republican majority in the future. Linda in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Linda.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I wish the guy from Cato Kalen High was still on. He really burns my toast. But my first two kids went to public school, and now our last two have been homeschooled, one of which I'm glad to say is in college, getting straight A's, and the other 13 and doing high school. And we're not anti-public school at all. In fact, my husband and I both went to school in the 60s and 70s. And I remember public school doing just fine. We had art. We had music. We had library skills. We had phonics, good old days of phonics and civics and critical thinking, life skills, and, you know, and we learned a lot about pollution and recycling and the population explosion and all of this wonderful stuff. And now I'm seeing candidates running for office on a platform of, if you elect me, I'll return art, music, and language to the schools. Mm-hmm. And we had to sit there and watch in horror, you know, as Reagan in the 80s first and now, you know, exponentially worse, Bush, the past 6 years. They have not only stripped the schools of all of this stuff, so that we had to resort to homeschooling just to make sure they had an honest and comprehensive education. We have friends who are teachers who are constantly lamenting how all of the corporations who've moved into schools are providing textbooks. You know, the logging company provides the textbooks that say, what deforestation? Right. Logging is good, you know, and Exxon gives you the ones that say, what global warming? And we actually bought a textbook at the bookstore for our child, which then as I sat down and analyzed it first, I'm going, why does it not say anything about the New Deal when they talk about Roosevelt?
Right.
Why is it not selling this? Why isn't it? You know,
and you have sponsorships now. I mean, there are book publishers, math book publishers, that are getting money from the candy companies where it says, okay, you've got one candy bar, brand name candy bar. You know, I don't know the brand names off the top of my head. So let's just say, for example, you've got one bag of M&Ms. It's got 55 M&Ms in it. Ralph gets 20. Sally gets 11. How many are left? I mean, that's how some of the math questions are being done now.
Oh, exactly. We my son goes to the Boys and Girls Club, and he was in a computer program they were doing, and they were learning to make websites and things. Well, one of the things they did was they gave all the kids in the class a standardized math and verbal and English skills test, just kind of out of nowhere, because apparently this program is a national program. It's called Miracles, and it's to help inner-city kids learn computer and business skills and things like that so they can compete and for jobs. And my son, who's the only homeschooled kid there, came out not only at the top, but I mean there was such a difference between his scores and the kids coming in second and beyond that we were like our mouths hanging open. And the director of the program said that when they were grading them and they came down and saw his score, they looked at each other and said, well, homeschooling works. Because we have watched No Child Left Behind, which is such a joke. It's a recruitment tool tied to let's teach them just read and write and arithmetic so we can say, look at the good scores on the standardized test, which is really saying we don't want them to know science, we don't want them to know civics, because we don't want them to question anything.
Right,
and
we don't want
them
challenging.
To not be led by the nose. We had one teacher friend who ran a poll.
No, I'm sorry, Linda. We've got to take a break here, but your point is well taken. And it is absolutely, we don't want them to be questioning evolution. We don't want them to be, what? Evolution? What details under it? And let me say, it is not the fault of the teachers or the teachers' union. This is the great purge that started in the 80s under Reagan of our public schools. 45 minutes back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Look up, Welcome back to Listener Supported Radio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, supported by you, our listeners, listening to your local station for sponsors that you can support and letting them know you're listening. And also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, the stuff that I drink in the morning. This program fueled by Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now and all things Macintosh at smalldog.com and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECOWINE. And today is JFK's birthday, by the way. We're gonna get into that in just a minute. But this whole issue of education and where we're going with it and where it's coming from and how, and yeah, I just want to wrap the hour up on this, and then we're going to get into, you know, the Republicans' plan for 2008 and what about what's going on in Iraq and war and peace and just those really and crucial fundamental issues. Steve in Mountain View, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. Just couple quick points. I got a tested IQ over 140. I'm a member of Mensa, and I was put out in the hall in the fourth grade because I didn't do long division the way they thought I should. My son has similar situation here in California. The public schools have been rotted out to the point where he scored off the charts and couldn't get a scholarship into Berkeley because I'm an engineer in Silicon Valley and made too much money.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, the whole system's all screwed up. You know, the only thing that saved me, I mean, you know, was Sputnik. Sputnik went up in 57 and Eisenhower went nuts and I was in first grade and all this money came into the public schools for gifted kids. And myself and a friend of mine, Terry, and his IQ was 1 point higher than mine. I was 141. He was 142.
Right.
And he always teased me about it. But in any case, we got pulled out of our school. And for the next 5 years, I mean, I had 2 years of a foreign language. I had Latin. I had math all the way through trig. I was reading at end of high school by the end of the sixth grade. And that saved me. I am convinced that had it not been for Sputnik and it had not been for those programs for gifted kids in the 1950s, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, actually, through the early 60s, that I would have been another one of those kids stuck on Ritalin and kind of,
exactly.
Let's just shuffle them through. And,
well,
absolutely.
To make it really sharp in terms of the difference, my father taught English in Bloomfield Hills, which was where the rich kids went to school. And a benefit was I got to go to school in Bloomfield Hills for a few years. And I came back to the schools in Pontiac, which is where all the factory kids went to school.
Yeah.
And I was, and in 2 or 3 years, I had pulled ahead of my fellow students by 5 or 6 years.
I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, in Lansing school. But that was back in the day when education was flexible, when classes were relatively small. I mean, 20, 30 kids typically in a classroom, when teachers had a lot of latitude and they could work with individual kids. I mean, it's a whole completely different world now, Steve. And for kids like you and me and kids like your kid and my kids, I mean, you know, we saw this with all three of our children. And it is a system that is failing, and it's not the fault of the teachers, and it's not for lack of throwing money at it. This is one of the big concerns, and Steve, thanks for the call. This is one of the big conservative things. Oh, you realize we're spending twice as much on education now as we were in 1950? Well, in 1950, there were only 140 million people in the United States. There's 300 million people in the United States now. In 1950, you could buy a 3-bedroom home in a major city for $15,000 a year, for $15,000. Now it's, you know, what, $300,000, $400,000? I mean, you know, come on. The conservatives all the time are going, oh, you wouldn't believe it. It now costs $10,000. It's all the teachers' union. But no, it's not. Population has gone up, so there's more kids who are in our schools, number one, and so of course we're spending more on education, and number two, inflation has eroded the value of the dollar to the point where it's a joke, and so of course we're spending more money on education. That doesn't mean that throwing money at the problem doesn't actually help. If you could reduce I tell you this as somebody who's been on the chairman of the board of a private school for the last dozen years, and seen it and been through it with my own kids and written 7 books about education and been a consultant to school districts literally from Taiwan to the United States to England, that the biggest single variable if you want to improve the quality of education is class size. You get your class size down below 30 kids and you're going to see some spectacular results. You get up below 20 kids, you're going to see really spectacular results. And then you get the No Child Left Behind crowd out of there who are telling you what you can and can't teach. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. Frank in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Frank.
How are you doing? You know, this whole game that the Republicans are playing, like the exit exams, kids are not going to stay an extra year to pass the exit exam. Just they're trying to dumb down America like Ronald Reagan did. And, you know, self-starters are good for private tutoring, but they're you can't. And you know, they want to break down the public school system, and private schools are selective in who they say, who they pick to go there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of kids would be omitted from going to school at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Our private school takes the kids who can't succeed anywhere else. And so, yeah, so we don't have the greatest statistics, but a lot of private schools only take, they cherry pick what kids they'll take so that they can brag about the academic success of their kids. Kevin, got about 30 seconds before we have to wrap this hour up in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Hello from such a liberal bastion out here at Lake.
Indeed.
And I just wanted to mention that the problem even gets to, like, for sports.
When I and was music.
For, pardon me?
And music. And other groups.
Yeah. Well, the school would provide the equipment for sports when I was coming up through. Mm-hmm. And now I've had, children coming to my door for a bake sale or for selling magazines so that they can play their sports and get their equipment.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And sports is an important part of school. I mean, it provides an opportunity for kids to learn team activities and become physically fit. Music is an important thing. Art programs, second language programs, all of these things are actually necessary to become a well-rounded individual. And, you know, what do the conservatives want to do? Get rid of all of them. Let's just teach a very narrow range of things. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Let's talk about war and peace. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Today, in 1917, John Fitzgerald Kennedy was born. An advocate of peace. We'll get to that in just a second. And over the weekend, Cindy Sheehan, who I wrote one of the forewords to her book, I Know Cindy. I don't know her real well, but I know her. She's been on the program a number of times. We've talked many times. She's had a hell of a difficult time over the last few years. She has, the hate that has been directed against her, particularly by the right. And then, you know, getting involved in the left and not going into this with the level of sophistication held by many, or experience, frankly, of many of the people who are already in the peace movement and have been for decades. And not understanding the lay of the land with the various peace movements out there, and everybody has their own agenda in addition to the agenda of peace. And she just, I think the machine got her. And she got chewed up and spit out. But apparently, from reading her piece, you can read this over at commondreams.org as well. It's also over on buzzflash.com. And I think it's also at the Daily Kos. It's all over. She wrote a piece. She titled it, Good Riddance, Attention Whore, which is a phrase that the right has thrown at her, in which she says, when I started to hold the Democratic Party to the same standards that I held the Republican Party, support for my cause started to erode, and the, quote, left, end quote, started labeling me with the same slurs that the right used. I guess no one paid attention to me when I said the issues of peace and people dying for no reason is not a matter of right or left, but a matter of right and wrong. She says, I am demonized because I don't see party affiliation or nationality. When I look at a person, I see that person's heart. She says she sacrificed a 29-year marriage, time away from Casey's, her dead son's brother and sisters, and her health has suffered, and her hospital bills are now in collection. She's broke. She says, the most devastating conclusion that I reached this morning, however, was that Casey did indeed die for nothing. She said, it's hard to work for peace when the very movement that it's named after has so many divisions, and she talks about that. And then she says, this is not my checkers moment, referring to Nixon's concession speech. back in 1960, it was before that, when he trotted Pat out in his dog checkers and Pat's plaid coat and said he would never run again. She says, "This is not my checkers moment because I will never give up trying to help people in the world who are harmed by the empire of the good old USA." But then she ends it by saying, "It's up to you now." In other words, she's going to go back home and take care of business. And I understand and respect that. At the same time, her article really takes the Democrats to task for this vote. And I wrote a piece in today's that is on Common Dreams this morning about how this is really the beginning of the Republican strategy for 2008 is what we're seeing. And it's a very simple four-step strategy. And frankly, they're quite open about it. I mean, Mitch McConnell was talking about this on TV over the weekend. Number one, shift ownership of the war. All the downside, all the deaths, all that. Shift that to the Democrats. The so-called war, the occupation. Shift that over to the Democrats. And they've done that. I mean, even though it was a majority of Republicans in Congress that, at least according to some Democrats like Steny Hoyer, required the Democrats to put this thing on the table so it could be passed. Even though it was a majority of Republicans who voted for it, and many, many Democrats voted against it, the mainstream media, the corporate media out there for the last 3 days has been going, well, now that the Democrats have given Bush what he... the Democrats rolled over. The Democrats caved in. Now the Democrats have given Bush... Well, some of the Democrats did. Not all of them, but some of them did. And frankly, I think it was a strategic mistake politically. And I think it was a disaster because it means that the war is going to be prolonged, even if it's another month, and more people are going to die unnecessarily. But that said, this isn't the Democrats' war. This is the Republicans' war. But the media is doing everything they can right now to make sure that the ownership of this war or this occupation rests in the lap of the Democrats. And there's a very real strategy attached to that. Number one, shift ownership of the war to the Democrats. Number two, begin to wind down the American involvement in the occupation of Iraq no later than the spring or summer of 2008. How do they do this? They're going to, Bush came out and said it. There was an article in the New York Times a couple days ago saying, you know, he has a secret plan to start basically following the Baker-Hamilton Commission and redeploy U.S. forces out of combat areas and into the 14 cities that we're building around Iraq that we call military bases and the Green Zone, our so-called embassy. So what are you going to see? You're going to see U.S. casualties drop down to, you know, 5, 6, 8 a month instead of 100 a month. And since the reporters won't leave the Green Zone in those areas of Iraq where there's ethnic cleansing going on and you know, terrible disaster, it's not even going to be covered in the American press. Just like Afghanistan. Some huge portion of Afghanistan right now is controlled by the Taliban or the warlords. I mean, well over 80% of the landmass. You've got basically two cities that Hamid Karzai is in charge of. They refer to him laughingly as the mayor of Kabul. Because he basically, you know, there's two cities, the capital city and the next largest city, Kandahar, in Afghanistan, the only two cities where he really has any power. Every place else is ruled by the Taliban or the warlords. And yet the average American thinks we have won in Afghanistan. No. So they will create that same illusion in Iraq. Number three, claim victory and get out of direct combat. Well, that's what I just said. And number four, win big. This is the Republican strategy. Win big in the 2008 elections by claiming that they have won a war and that those Democratic surrender monkeys were all wrong and we just proved them wrong and how dare they and they shouldn't have been, you know, quack, quack, quack. So on John Kennedy's birthday, let's consider some of his thoughts on these issues of war and peace.
I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds. And the truth too rarely perceived. And that is the most important topic on earth.
Peace.
The most important topic on earth.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war, not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
This is how statesmen talked back in the day.
I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task.
Nowadays, only Dennis Kucinich is talking like this, and they make fun of him for it.
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
Oh, but now we have the axis of evil, Mr. Kennedy, didn't you know?
Our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants and purely rhetorical hostility.
This, of course, was the era before John Bolton.
For we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute.
Until George W. Bush came along.
Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished.
Can you imagine the guy who said that the top 10 floors of the UN, or however many floors it was, should be blown up, was actually appointed by Bush as our ambassador to the United Nations? 16 minutes past the hour. That was John Kennedy, by the way, speaking at Michigan State University back in 1963.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Yeah, we all want to know. Indeed. Back to the days when politicians actually talked as if they were statesmen and stateswomen, when the positions that they took were principled positions rather than partisan hack positions. I mean, the essence of the article that I published on Common Dreams today, and it'll be, as the day goes on, we'll be spamming it out or sending it out to all the various websites We'll send it out to our newsletter list this afternoon when I get home. The essence, and by the way, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com, click live chat up at the top, or AirAmerica.com and click Tom Hartman, and it'll take you to the Tom Hartman page, and there's a link to our live chat room there. But the essence of the article that I wrote is that the Republicans are playing a very, very cynical political game with Iraq. And they have been from day one, literally from the first day of the Bush administration. Ever since George W. Bush was appointed president by the Supreme Court, they have been using Iraq for political gain. There have been all kinds of great side effects, side benefits for them. They got oil for their buddies. They got money for their military contractor buddies. They got, you know, there's a lot of things that have worked out very well for them. Thank you very much. But the main thing was they got political power. That was what it was all about. Because as James Madison pointed out, during time of war, a president's ability to give out favors and appoint people to offices and pass out money is dramatically expanded. In fact, that's why Madison said no nation can retain its freedom in a state of perpetual war. and why people who really and truly understood this and believe in the greatness of America and believe in America's commitment to historic commitment to peace, like John Kennedy, whose birthday is today, spoke so aggressively, wrong word, I guess that's a mixing of metaphors, was so outspoken about peace. John Kennedy.
The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war.
Oops.
We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
He hadn't reckoned with George W.
We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
Now, can you imagine a political candidate, a presidential, I mean, we all saw this spectacle, this tragic, horrifying, disgusting, you know, I lack adjectives. I mean, it was all of that and more. We all saw this spectacle on TV, or those of us who watched it, of the Republican debate, where the Republicans were trying to out-warmonger each other.
Oh, I'll throw them in prison. I'll torture them. We need another war.
Can you imagine when Republicans ran on the platform of peace? Of peace. Here's Dwight Eisenhower's campaign ad in 1952.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. The Republican! I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing. And so here we have the Republican Party is once again, I predict, the Republican Party is once again going to become the party of peace. And the way that they're going to do it is by completely reinventing themselves between now and November of 2008. And they're going to do that by following the plans that have been laid out by the Democrats. Nancy Pelosi and Democrats in Congress gave a blueprint in this piece of legislation that George W. Bush vetoed, gave a blueprint for how to withdraw successfully from direct engagement and being an irritant in Iraq and bringing other nations into the region and bringing about a reasonable peace. I mean, we've got such a disaster in Iraq. There's a story in today's New York Times about how the world's second largest refugee disaster crisis behind Darfur is Iraq. 2 million internal refugees, 2 million external refugees. And how in many of these Iraqi refugees, the story profiles a 16-year-old girl who has become a prostitute. And that this is just absolutely, totally common now all over the Middle East, that young Iraqi girls are working as prostitutes because there's nothing left. They're supporting their families. They got nothing. They're living in refugee camps in these rich Arab countries. I mean, this is what we have brought Iraq. So anyhow, the Republicans are going to reinvent themselves as the party of peace by redeploying our forces over the next 12 months to these cities that we call our military bases within Iraq and getting them out of the conflict. And they're going to do, you know, exactly what was recommended to LBJ back in the day, declare victory and get out. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
There once was a musical troupe, a pickin' singin' folk group. They sang the mountain ballads and the folk songs of our land. They were long on musical ability. Folks thought they would go far. But political incompatibility led to their downfall. Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right, and the one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear was a Methodist.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Hey, just a reminder, I'll be at the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. on Radio Row, and I'll also be speaking at the conference. Come by, come visit and say hi. You can get details at ourfuture.org. That's June 18th through the 20th. And, of course, next week I will be in Dubrovnik, Croatia at the Praxis Peace Conference. Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, peace.org is their website. And we're trying to work it out with the Croatian State Television to get a studio so that we can do the at least the Monday and Thursday show live from Dubrovnik, Croatia. And Peter B. Collins, in all probability, will be filling in for me the rest of the week. And we're working that out with Peter as we speak. 35 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. All sorts of cool stuff over there at airamerica.com as well, and you can click on Tom Hartman there, and that will take you into the area where you can find our chat room. Jesse in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Tom. Happy birthday to JFK. Even for a stellar performance in life, he didn't get a thorough investigation into his murder, but I'll move on. With the confirmation of Alito and Robertson, that pretty much showed the Democrats' hand anyway. You know, everything's a political calculation.
Yeah. There was a profound lack of courage there on the part of the Democrats. I agree with you, Jesse. And in fact, many of us were calling the Democrats in the Senate and saying, you know, don't vote for these guys. Don't do it. Let's bork them. Let's just say no. You guys can what's happening right now is the Democrats are all saying, well, you know, you got to have 60 votes in the Senate to do anything. And yet when these two right-wingers were up for the Supreme Court, the Democrats controlled more than 40 votes. The Republicans didn't have 60 votes in the Senate. But they were out there playing hardball, threatening nuclear option and everything, and the Democrats were all, oh, no! It's time for them to get a spine. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Tom. You know, it seems to me we've been a victim of a rhetorical 1-2 punch by the state's mannequins of the Republican Party. You were talking about the framing of it, the support the troops. That really equals if dissent is disloyalty. If you don't support the troops, somehow you're disloyal.
And the Democrats were repeating that mantra.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what's so mind-boggling.
You know,
and they continue to use the word war instead of the word occupation when you had a Republican senator over the weekend, Jeff Sessions, stand up and say, this is no longer a war, it's an occupation.
Absolutely.
Where were the Democrats?
The slogan, the surge, is really just stay the course, and when they stand up, we'll stand down. In other words, we're wholly dependent on Bush's say-so for when that's going to happen, and accepting the slogan, the war on terror, that's not a policy, it's a bumper sticker, and that's really a stalking horse that allows them to short-circuit any, you know, real full-throated discussion of torture or wiretapping. So everything is, we're dependent on their framing of it. Nobody speaks out otherwise. And we're all lost here because we can't even go to, people go to court to sue because they've been mistreated, and the judges rule it's too classified a matter. We can't talk about it. It's incredible.
I absolutely agree with you, Charlie, and well said. And the two big problems are, number one, the Republican frame gets repeated because they do it so well. First of all, they do it very carefully and very thoughtfully. By the way, my new book on how Democrats can frame this stuff, it's not out for sale yet, but it's up on Amazon. If you go to TomHartmann.com, you can click through and see it. Cracking the Code, the book that we wrote on the air here on this program over the course of the last year, just went up. In any case, they so masterfully define the frame, and then through their literally $3 billion network of think tanks, they get that frame into the mainstream media, and they get every single Republican using it, and pretty soon the Democrats believe that they have no choice but to use the frame. And, of course, you've got some Democrats, you know, the Lieberman faction of the Democratic Party and, to some extent, the DLC faction of the Democratic Party, who will enthusiastically use the frame because it supports the military-industrial complex and the oil industry and all that, the folks who help fund their elections. Jerry, New York. Hey, or
yeah.
Long Island. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah. thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, well, I agree with you on the frame, on we need to control the framing. I also agree with Sidney Sheehan. I think she's 100% correct that Democrats in Congress deserve to be criticized on the war funding, or should I say occupation funding issue.
I agree, and I would. There's one word I want to insert there, and I think that it's really important that we all insert that, and that is some Democrats. There are still some good Democrats there, and there might even be one or two good Republicans. No names come to mind immediately, but there might be. But some Democrats decided to hand this thing over to the Republicans. Not all Democrats. For example, I'm from Oregon. Every single Democrat in my congressional delegation, David Wu, Darlene Hooley, Earl Blumenauer, the whole bunch of them, Peter DeFazio, they all voted no on this. And God bless him. And our senator, Ron Wyden from Oregon, voted no on it. So, you know, it's anyway. Pat in Granite Falls, Washington, listening on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Hey, Pat.
Oh, Tom, I'm so happy to speak to you. I would like to say one thing first, if you don't mind, about Cindy Sheehan. Her dear son did not die in vain. He inspired his mother to fight on. And she's been an inspiration for all of us. She deserves a Purple Heart or a Medal of Honor. And then to go on to the question I have to ask you, is there anything we can do to prevent George Bush from taking us into another war? Is there anything? It's like watching a car rolling downhill in slow motion towards the edge of a cliff, and we're all standing watching it.
You know, back before the elections in November, we had Seymour Hersh, the investigative journalist on this program, and we had also Scott Ritter, the weapons inspector. Both of them were saying March or April of 2007, that was, you know, last month, the month before, that we were going to attack Iran, that the plans were in place, the battleships were deployed, the moon was right, everything was there, we were going to do it. And this was before the elections. The elections, in my opinion, changed things. It's like, you know, there's this story out of Vietnam that not a lot of people know. Richard Nixon was actually planning on using tactical nuclear weapons in Vietnam.
Oh.
And a million people came out and marched onto Washington, D.C. and filled the plaza and literally a million people marched on Washington, D.C. And Richard Nixon, as a result of that march, and we didn't learn this until 20 years later when we actually sat down and started listening to the Watergate tapes, Richard Nixon, as a result of that march, decided not to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. I believe that because of the election of the Democrats in the 2006 election, and because there is now a strong opposition in the House and the Senate, that the probability of an attack on Iran has been dramatically diminished, and that's the only thing that has prevented Bush from attacking up until now. And the danger is that Joe Lieberman could get so enthusiastic about attacking Iran that he could decide to flip to Republican, and then we'd have a year and a half of the Republican Senate, and it would be much harder for the Democrats to prevent Bush from having his little war with Iran. But I suspect now that they've done the political calculus, Bush and Rove have done the political calculus, and although Cheney doesn't go along with it, because Cheney doesn't care about politics, Cheney just wants war. He just, you know, dead bodies, yeah. Cheney just wants war. And it's interesting to read the articles, particularly in the conservative press, about the schism between Cheney and Bush. But I think that Cheney's power is waning. And the Republican strategy of, okay, let's adopt peace, it's where the American people are at, we're going to move there, is waxing. So what can you do to ensure that Bush doesn't attack Iran? Contact your elected officials and say, I do not want a war with Iran, and I want us out of Iraq, and please don't vote for any more funding for this war, because it should have stopped. It should have ended 3 years ago. When we declared victory 4 years ago, on May 1st, 2003, when Bush declared victory on the USS Abraham Lincoln, he had, in fact, successfully knocked over a government.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
It was true. It was an illegal war. It was an illegal invasion. It was like Hitler's invasion of Poland, but he really did win. He did take down the government. Then began from May 1st of 2003 until this day, the illegal occupation of Iraq, and that's what's melting down and what's not working. And so... Mickey in Seattle. Hey, Mickey, just got a half a minute or so before we got to take a break.
Well, I had a little more than half a minute, but I kind of wanted to go off on a rant that I just received this fundraising letter from Patty Murray talking about how we have to hold the president accountable on Iraq. And, of course, she and Marie Cantwell both voted for the Iraqi supplemental.
I know. So that rather astounded me.
It's totally hypocritical. I called her political campaign office, and, of course, they can't really answer my questions because it's all about spin, and they're not very good at the spin where the Republicans, as you said, are masters at it. But I'm really fuming that she wants my money when she just voted this way.
Well, I salute you, Mickey, for calling her office and letting her know, because that's really what it takes. We have to contact our elected representatives and let them know how we think about their behavior. And also, you know, in some small way, keep in mind that, you know, one vote, it should not be the entire record of anybody in the House or Senate. But nonetheless, this is a very important vote. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Want to shout out.
Speaking of everybody's cross, Cindy Sheehan quitting the peace movement. This is one very, very tragically wounded woman. And I think, you know, she's in need of all of our prayers or light or, you know, build an altar or light a candle or whatever for Cindy Sheehan. Here she's broke, I mean, with all these hospital bills and everything else. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service out of Washington, D.C. on the line, talkradionews.com. Hey, good morning, or good afternoon, or whatever it is.
Good day.
Yeah,
well, I think that the thing that shocks me, although I'm not shocked, is the court discrimination case that came up. It was Ledbetter versus Goodyear. This was a woman who worked for Goodyear. She started out on equal pay, and then she retired in 1998. She found out that, in fact, that when she was paid $3,727 a month. Lowest manager in her same area paid about $4,200 a month. Highest paid $5,200 a month. She sued for discrimination, but the law says that you must sue within 180 days of when the discrimination happened.
I'm sorry.
So, Mr. Alito wrote for the majority, which was, of course, 5-4, because of him, and Bader Ginsburg wrote for the minority, and she essentially said that that she said this reading of the statute makes little sense, unlike with a firing, because both an employee may not be aware of the discriminatory nature of their pay and until much later, and it is illogical to hold that only an initial decision to discriminate, but not the discriminatory pay itself, constitute unlawful practice. Plus, how are you essentially, to summarize, how are you supposed to know about this within that 180 days if you don't
know? Well, and beyond that, what Ruth Bader Ginsburg is saying is that if this woman is continuing to get a pension based on a pay which is the consequence of discrimination, then the crime is continuing to be committed. So she's within her 180 days because the crime is still being committed.
Right, but that's not how Alito and his gang decided it.
Was it the Catholic Five by any chance?
Well, I'm sure. I mean, it had to be. I didn't see the exact, but I'm sure Stevens, Ginsburg. I'm sure it was the normal 5-4, with Kennedy.
Kennedy, Alito, Roberts, Thomas, and Scalia.
That's right.
You know, in all probability.
Exactly.
I say that not to trash Catholics. I know people get all upset whenever I say the Catholic Five. And on abortion, I really think that there is a religious tinge to their decisions. But beyond that, I'd say they're basically the conservative nutcase five. But in any case, or at least four of them. So that's number one.
That's number one. Darfur, the president made a statement today before he left for Georgia. He did do one thing that Clinton never did with Rwanda, and he did say the word genocide. Now, a lot of people, and Senator Russ Feingold, who actually is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on African Affairs, said that it was a long overdue announcement, and that he's glad he strengthened the sanctions on the Sudan, etc. But it does try and get the United Nations Security Council to do this. But one of the things the sanctions has in them is to stop American businesses from doing business with some of these people. And it's interesting because New York Times had a totally different article today about the fact that there are terrorist 501c3s, nonprofits operating, and there's sort of a list of them, and the IRS is not using that list to double check when people file their tax returns.
Well, you know, what I find, if I may just for a moment jump in, what I find amazing is the definition of terrorist. For example, we found that the Alabama Department of Homeland Security had on their terrorist watch list, on their official website, groups like anti-war groups, pro-gay groups, things like this.
And everybody will come in when saying that the IRS list is, total crock.
But I wonder if Liberty University is on that list, which produced a guy who showed up with a bomb at Jerry Falwell's funeral.
Who knows?
Oh, he was not a terrorist.
But what I will say is that it shows that even when they're given a list, whether we like what's on the list or not, they're not capable of enforcing it. So how are they going to enforce these 30 businessmen and these supposed corporations that do business with Darfur? The enforcement, they don't pay any attention even when they supposedly have a terrorist list.
Right.
So I think the enforcement is going to be very, very weak on that. But I do have to give Bush credit after a lot of pressure for calling it genocide. So got to give him a little credit for that.
Now, if he would just acknowledge that the world's second largest refugee problem with 4 million refugees, 2 million internally displaced persons, and 2 million externally, this article in today's New York Times about how 16-year-old Iraqi girls are becoming prostitutes in Arab countries all around the region now because that's the only way they can support their families, that is in Iraq. I mean, it's the second largest refugee problem in the world.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, and you know what's interesting is that if you read the United Nations material beforehand, before the war, it was very clear that they were expecting there to be 3 to 5 million refugees. So the United Nations report and Red Cross report hit it right on the head way before the war, over 4 years ago. One other thing, United States rejected the European Union's target on carbon emissions today. The United States said that they believe in goals, but they're against goals, but they want to set them on specific sectors. They don't want an overall goal. Why am I not surprised?
So we don't need no stinking science. We're not worried about global warming.
Exactly.
We'll just deal with
it in general terms.
Yeah, this has got to be making the Europeans crazy, particularly Blair and Merkel.
As the G8 is coming up, absolutely.
Yeah. When is that, by the way?
The president leaves from the 4th to the 11th, but he's doing a couple stops before, so I think it's like the 6th to the 8th.
The first week of June, basically.
Right, the president leaves on the 4th.
Okay. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com. Drop by our live chat room and say hi to some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. It's free. Greg Palast is with us. GregPalast.com, his website. The New York Times best-selling author, BBC reporter, all-around brilliant guy. His new book, Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild, a new edition just released last month. Hey, Greg.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you with us. You did a really good roundup piece, a deconstruction of the whole Monica. This is the new Monica. I miss the old Monica, frankly. The old Monica. Go ahead.
Much hotter than anything with a blue dress. I'm not talking physically. I'm talking about informationally.
This is
a hot story. And what was missed there, here we have this woman who is inside the belly of the beasties who says, I have to take the Fifth Amendment. I need immunity because I have something to tell you. And she immediately started saying, look, I have to confess, the whole team knew about Tim Griffin and caging voters in the 2004 election, and I have to confess it. You know, and she's doing this under immunity, and the members of the committee said, well, so what? We have other things to ask you about. No one asked her.
Here,
what
in fact,
talking about?
Well, actually, Loretta Sanchez she apparently asked out of ignorance because what Goodling did was she did a little song and dance about, oh, it's a direct mail technique. Here's the original testimony for our listeners who aren't familiar with what you're talking about. This is just a little seven second clip of Monica Goodling. She's speaking about Paul McNulty and the number two guy to Gonzalez and what he failed to say when he was testifying under oath before Congress.
Failed to disclose that he had some knowledge of allegations that Tim Griffin had been involved in vote caging during his work on the president's 2004 campaign.
Now, she says allegations.
Yeah. Well, of course, they're my allegations from BBC television. But we discovered, because, you know, Karl Rove not being the sharpest knife in the drawer, his people mistyped 500 emails. We got crucial ones. In fact, right in our madhouse, I have the most incriminating ones, the one she's talking about. And I know she's talking about these allegations because her own emails that were subpoenaed by the Judiciary Committee have her and her bosses and the whole Rove gang screaming about that British reporter, Greg Palast. And obviously, Tom, you know that from my accent. I ain't British. I mean, maybe Carl's. I'm American. Maybe Carl's un-American, but that's a whole different matter. The point is, what is all this stuff about caging Tim Griffin, et cetera? This was the means by which they knocked off thousands upon thousands of legal voters. And it being Memorial Day, I should note that their biggest target was to knock off the votes of black soldiers. Yes, caging is a direct mail term. What they did was they sent letters to new voters, black voters. When the letters came back, returned, because they couldn't be delivered to the registration address, that is, they were received by the Republicans, by the Rove bots, and that's called caging. So they caged those letters, then they challenged the votes of those letters that were of those registered voters whose letters were returned, saying, hey, they don't live at their registration addresses. Well, have you ever thought, Mr. Rove and Mr. Bush, why a soldier might not be living at his registered home address? Tick tock, tick tock. What's the winning answer? Baghdad. It was sickening to just see page after page of African American soldiers, sailors, airmen who were knocked off the voter rolls, or their absentee ballot was thrown in the garbage. They didn't even know, because, right, you send your absentee ballot from overseas in the military.
They checked off the box and mailed it in. They thought everything was fine.
And they thought everything was fine, and they lost it. Over 500,000 absentee ballots were thrown out. And who was the guy in charge of this? Well, Rove doesn't do all the little stuff by himself. The guy in charge of this caging operation was Tim Griffin. Tim Griffin today, U.S. prosecutor for Arkansas. In other words, the perpetrator, by the way, when you knock off black soldiers, when you challenge their vote knowing that they are serving overseas, that's against the law. It's a felony crime. The guy who committed it is a guy named Tim Griffin. So Monica says she knew that Griffin knew about it. He didn't just know. He was in charge. Now, he is Karl Rove's right-hand man. So, in other words, the Rove operation, Tim Griffin directing, now U.S. prosecutor, and this is what it's all about. What they have done is they have placed, that they not only got rid of the decent, honest nine prosecutors, like David Iglesias, they replaced them with Rove bots who for the 2008 election are in place. They've already had experience fixing elections. They're in place to do it again. It's all about the election. Monica was trying to tell the committee she did it under grant of immunity because she knew this was a crime and she had to lay it out. But if no one asks about it, she's immunized. She walks away home free. She can never go to jail for it. And if no one asks, so be it.
And it really didn't go anywhere. I mean, I'm just astounded that that wasn't the headline in the New York Times. The Republican Party since 1986 has been operating under a restraining order preventing them from doing this.
Yes. In 1981, the Republicans pulled this little stunt again. But then we used to have something called the Justice Department. Now we have something called an Injustice Department, by those in the know. And they don't bust people for knocking out black voters. In other words, the Republican Party is...
No, they promote them. They promote them.
Yeah.
What increasingly it seems to me that the Republican Party should be prosecuted under something that resembles the RICO laws.
Yes.
And I went back and I read the RICO laws, and they're very, very narrowly defined and obviously targeted toward organized crime.
Well, actually,
is there? Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I used to be a RICO, a racketeering investigator for the government, so I know all about RICO. And this is as. Bobby Kennedy, who's also working with me, a civil rights attorney, this is classic RICO. You have a criminal, what's called a criminal enterprise, a conspiracy among top people to violate the civil rights. So it's a violation of the Voting Rights Act. It's a violation
right,
of
the RICO rights. Act doesn't specify civil rights as one of the
right.
One of the types
be,
of...
It's got to be a money crime involved.
Right. It's money laundering. It's about the only area that I could see where they
well,
can get them under RICO.
You do have that Tim Griffin got a promotion. There might be a way to put it under RICO, but certainly it's Voting Rights Act of 65, a felony crime. But here's the problem, Tom. No matter what the law says, who's going to bust them? Is Tim Griffin going to read himself his rights?
Now, right. You need a federal prosecutor to put these guys in jail, and they happen to be the federal prosecutors.
Now, you can kind of hear I'm at an airport because I'm flying down to Washington for BBC television because we're going to be speaking with Chairman Conyers about this and other topics, I hope. And so there's a guy who does know his stuff, and
sure.
It's been following my material very, very closely. What we have to do is that the problem is, of course, I mean, look, it's not like it's hidden. I mean, when Monica talks about those allegations, the missing Rove email that the committee is looking for is sitting there on page 207 of our manhouse. And it says Tim Griffin's name right at the top. It says caging list. This caging operation is pure up illegal. And you have to understand, it's not over with. Those people who are challenged are still challenged as of today. This poison stays in the system through the 2008 election. And one of my great disappointments was that one of the Senate side staffers, not Conyers people, when Bobby Kennedy called up his uncle's committee and said, you know, you really should look at the palace the evidence from BBC television. He's got the emails. They said, well, Tim Griffin, the U.S. prosecutor, he's only an interim appointee. Well, yes, that's true. He's
yeah,
interim.
Until 2008.
He's interim through the
until after the elections.
Right. So
right.
That's all they care about. That's all they care about. This is
so
all about
this whole Gonzo Gate, this whole prosecutor thing,
yes.
These federal attorneys. In your mind, what this is all about is the 2008 elections.
It's not just in my mind. If you look, you have to read their own emails, not only the ones that I captured, but even more important, the ones that were actually coughed up by the committee. They are saying, in fact, in one of the emails complaining about that British reporter Greg Pallas, they talk about this is all about the election. They know it. We know it. It's not about getting rid of unloyal, disloyal prosecutors. David Iglesias, whom I know, is one of the most loyal, kind of madly loyal Republicans, given everything that's happened to him. So he's loyal. The problem is that he's not a criminal. He's not going to participate in phony prosecutions against Democrats while protecting the Republican Party, which is on a mass illegal challenge campaign. He's
right.
Not going to do
just
it.
Acting like the mob, and, yeah. And he's just not going to go along with it. Greg Pallast, gregpallast.com, the website. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller Armed Madhouse, new edition, just out last month, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. Some of the emails that the House and Senate are trying to subpoena from Karl Rove actually reprinted in Armed Madhouse. You can read them yourself. Greg Pallast, thanks for being with us.
Take it easy, Tom. Bye.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Bob in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Just great. Just great.
But I just want to preface my comment with a plug, which I've given you before a couple months ago when I spoke with you, that I think that the best way to solve all of the problems that are going on in this country and the world is for a prime time nightly, five nights a week TV show nationwide hosted by Tom Hartman. You, I know you don't want to do it, but I'm
thank you, but I'm a radio guy. But
I know.
Thanks for your kind words, Bob. That's not what you care about, though.
Yeah, let me just make a comment on something that's been
and by the way, let me just comment on that.
Okay.
If people are looking for good TV news, as PBS becomes increasingly contaminated by corporate sponsorships and by Republicans taking a majority of the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Amy Goodman is doing a just absolute brilliant job with Democracy Now, and I encourage people to check that out. So anyhow, back to you, Bob.
Okay. Just a comment on one of the talking points of Bush and the Republicans, and has been for years, is ever since this war started, is that we're going to stand down as soon as the Iraqis stand up. And this just keeps getting delayed and delayed and delayed. And I was in the Army 40 years ago. We had 8 weeks of basic training, and we were ready for, you know, war in the jungle, literally. Why are these Iraqis being allowed to get away with, you know, supposedly being trained, and they need more and more training? And
well, it's not a matter of being, it's not a matter of allowed to get away with. The problem is that, I mean, imagine if the United States, imagine if Mexico or Canada, for that matter, I mean, pick a country, said, or together, coalition of Mexico and Canada, said, George Bush wasn't really elected in 2000. Al Gore actually got a majority of the votes in Florida. The Supreme Court installed him. In 2004, because of caging and other election fraud, he didn't win Ohio. He was never elected president. He's illegitimate. We're going to go into the United States, and we're going to take out George Bush, take him out as president. We'll remove him as president, and we're going to seize control of the government. We're going to seize control of the infrastructure, and we're going to run the country right and help it become a democracy once again. And they invade our country, and they do that. But they don't actually hand the government back over to us. Instead, they set up some stooges of their own, and now we've got Canadian and Mexican stooges who are, you know, running our government, or, you know, Americans who are dancing to their tune. And they bring in Canadian and Mexican companies to rebuild America from all the damage. And they say, okay, we've got to stand up an American army that's loyal to us, the Canadians and the Mexicans. How many of us do you think would join that army? I think most of us would be out in the streets shooting at the Canadians and the Mexicans. And that's the problem that they have in Iraq. They can't stand up an army because they can't find people who are willing to participate with us in what is widely perceived in Iraq as an illegal occupation. And in fact, a lot of those 2 million refugees who have totally left Iraq, left because in the early days they were collaborating with the Americans, and they know that that's putting a giant bullseye on their back.
That makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's the bottom line, Bob. That's absolutely the bottom line, and that's why you can't stand up an army there. What you have to do is get the hell out, and then the government, and then bring in some of the people from the surrounding nations who do have legitimacy, who do share a religion and a heritage and a language, and have them work with the government to put together a military that, well, they don't even need a military. What they need is police. It's not like Iraq needs to fight a war against somebody. They need, you know, good old-fashioned safe streets. They need water that's pure. You know, only 20% of the population has access to pure water. They need sanitation systems that work. They need electricity more than 3 hours a day. I mean, they need the just simple, simple stuff. That's really the bottom line. Ed in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. Listen, my thought for the day, we were talking earlier a little bit about foot-dragging Democrats, and my thought is basically this. We need to be careful not to let our concerns about the Bush administration distract us from the fact that we also have some important internal house cleaning to do inside the Democratic Party. And we need to be gearing up right now to mount serious primary election challenges to some of the worst of the Bush-enabling Democrats and replace them with some real progressives in the primary elections that are coming up.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Ed. This is not a time to broad brush the entire Democratic Party and every Democrat out there and say, oh, my God, they're all terrible, and then just walk away. It's time to say, okay, who are the Democrats who are not really Democrats, you know, who are Republican light. Harry Truman once made the rather trenchant observation that people, you know, it's more important to voters to have somebody who is consistent with their beliefs and actually represents their district and does so in a way that's consistent than it is to have somebody who has a party affiliation. His exact quote was, if the voters are offered a choice between a Republican or a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, they'll choose the Republican every time. Now, this is from a Democratic president. And that was his point, is you know, be true to who you are and what you are. And by the way, in the 2000 election, those Democrats who really won big were the progressives. They were not the DLC Democrats. The DLC Democrats were the ones where they had to spend millions and millions of dollars, and they just eked in. They just squeaked by. It's the progressives who really won big. And, of course, the media didn't, you know, highlight that. They didn't point that out. It's not a secret, but it certainly, you know, I don't think most Americans know it because it really wasn't emphasized or pointed out. Why? Because the media aren't all that fond of progressives either. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Even when your hope is gone, move along, just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is strong, move along like I know you do. And even when your hope is gone, move along, just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is
strong. Sodium benzoate. Have you ever looked at a can of soda and seen sodium benzoate on it? This news story just out today from Food Production Daily. It must be an industry publication. Common preservative sodium benzoate, widely used in soft drinks and other foods, is again at the center of health concerns after research emerged linking it to cell damage. When they put it in a soft drink that contains vitamin C, it breaks down and forms benzene, which is a carcinogen. In the meantime, America's soft drink manufacturers are producing enough soda pop to provide 557 cans, 52.4 gallons, to every man, woman, and child in the United States. That's on the unhealthy side of the ledger. On the healthy side of the ledger, Citizens for Health, the voice of the natural health consumer, citizens with an S, .org, is talking about how the FDA has reopened, and I think today is the very last day, the comment period on the CAM guidelines. Now, you say, you know, why should I care, and what are the CAM guidelines? Frank Hurd is with us. He's the executive director of Citizens for Health, citizens.org. Hey, Frank.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
Good to have you with us. I'm fine. Tell us, what complementary and alternative medicines, CAM?
Correct. The full title of the guidance document that the FDA produced is the Guidance for Industry on Complementary and Alternative Medicine Products and their regulation by the Food and Drug Administration.
Now, is this an attempt to make it more difficult for us to get things like herbal remedies and vitamins and things, or for practitioners who use such things in their practices, naturopaths and the like, herbalists and whatnot, to have access to them?
Well, that is one of the concerns. I mean, to be clear, though, a guidance issued by the FDA is not going to change law or policy in and of itself. You know, only Congress can create or change law. However, it's the FDA's statement of its interpretation of existing law and policy and its authority in that area. So some of what it says with this guidance could be seen as a mandate or a direction for Congress to go down the line when considering the laws and policy that govern availability of supplements. So it
and
can't change
so,
the law itself, but it could lay the groundwork for the Congress to change the law down the line.
And I'm sure the pharmaceutical companies are looking at the vitamin industry and the herbal industry and just salivating.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, being the most profitable industry in the country right now, I guess, isn't enough. They know that over 150 million Americans every day use a supplement or some form of alternative health care. And, I mean, that's a huge pie that they'd like to dip a finger in.
Yeah. Yeah. So the comment period is today the last day now?
Correct. And that's another issue here because, you know, what we fight for here is freedom of choice in healthcare, but inherent in freedom of choice is availability of information. And the FDA originally posted the deadline for comments on this guidance as April 30th. After receiving over 125,000 comments on it, mostly negative, suddenly there appeared on their website an extension of the deadline to May 29th. However, we discovered on May 3rd that, lo and behold, suddenly it had been changed back to April 30th. So when we called and contacted the FDA to ask about that, they said that the original extension of the deadline had been posted in error by an employee and that that error had been discovered in mid-April. So, you know, question number one right there is why, as of May 3rd, was it still being posted as May 29th? But we generated a whole bunch more comments to the FDA on this, and we were called last week by the FDA to say that they had reopened the comment period through the 28th, which matches with what their own documentation says they should do.
Yeah. What are the practical consequences of that? I mean, for example, there's herbal supplements that I take. I like ginkgo biloba. I like Shizandra. There's a couple of herbs that I that I buy from health food companies. And I notice sometimes the stuff seems really fresh, and sometimes the stuff in the capsule. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it seems stale. What's wrong with having a regulatory agency say, "Hey, if you're saying that that's 325 milligrams of ginkgo biloba leaf, it actually has to be"?
No, there's nothing wrong with that at all. And in fact, the regulatory infrastructure exists already to provide that kind of safeguard. Nobody here is saying that somebody should be allowed to advertise a bottle as containing 500 milligrams of a substance, but only provide 300 milligrams of that substance. What we're saying is that there are decades, in some cases centuries, of reliable information. I mean, some of the best test group experimenting you can do, namely people from all cultures all over the world having used these substances for years and years and years, that have demonstrated their safe use. So we're not saying that it's a quality control issue. You should get what you expect to get from what the label says you're going to get. We're saying that the FDA's policy has amounted to a de facto censorship of meaningful, truthful health information that has existed for decades and in some cases centuries.
Interesting. Now, when I lived in Germany, I know that Hypericum, for example, which is Hypericin is the active ingredient in St. John's Wort, the plant, Hypericum perfoliatum, I think is the name of the botanical name of the plant,
mm-hmm.
It's a prescription drug in Germany anyway. And it's used for depression. It's also used as an antiviral. And, you can buy this stuff in the United States over the counter. And it seems to affect serotonin levels. I mean, there's a whole bunch of studies that it actually is more effective or as effective and arguably more effective, depending on the study that you're looking at, as many of the antidepressants that are sold as pharmaceuticals in the United States.
Exactly.
What's best for all of us? Is it best for all of us that this be standardized, that it come under the purview of some regulatory agency, or should it be the Wild West with regard to vitamins? I mean, this is what Henry Waxman is dealing with. Henry Waxman is taking a position that I strongly oppose, which is that all of these things should absolutely be regulated, in a very tight fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry, the health food industry, has I think done a pretty decent job of trying to crack down within itself. But on the other hand, it's an industry, you know.
Well, true. But first of all, that's the issue here is we're not, again, we're not saying it should be Wild West or completely restrictively regulated. And it is important to emphasize that there is regulatory oversight already in place between the FDA, the USDA, and the FTC. There are three different regulatory agencies that already oversee the dietary supplement industry and its marketing of products.
Right.
What we're afraid of, and it's interesting you mentioned Germany, because that's indicative of the direction that these policies and standards are going internationally through what's known as the Codex Alimentarius, the international code that governs food and food products. There's a push internationally to homogenize standards between countries and start moving towards a toxic science model versus a nutritional science model of looking at dietary supplements and foods. The main difference being that a toxic science model recognizes that a substance has a lethal dose, and it looks to advise the consumer on what that lethal dose is so it's not reached. A nutritional science model, which is the way we look at foods and supplements, says there isn't a lethal dose of this substance. There's an optimal dose, And the idea is to identify that optimal dose that's going to return the maximum positive health effects from taking it.
Yeah, well, so, what if there's both? I mean, if you drink too much water, as we saw in this stunt that this radio station did a while ago, you can die.
Right. Well, there's also common sense use and using as prescribed. What we're trying to decry here is a double standard between the pharmaceutical and the natural supplement industry. The natural supplement industry, you mentioned this as well, does a very good job of self-regulation because we're constantly put on the defensive about proving the reliability and safety of our products, even though every year that passes with deaths from traditional pharmaceuticals but none from the use of supplements, that reputation is further and further strengthened.
So what sort of comments, if people go to citizens.org and they want to make comments to the FDA, what needs to be said? What should be the nature of our comments?
Well, first of all, we don't fall on the sky is falling into the spectrum and say that there's some folks that anytime they hear the FDA breathe the word supplements, they get the chills. And I can, I can understand that, but this is not as a guidance itself going to implement, change, or do away with any policy or law.
However, all those emails, I mean, almost every other day I'm getting an email from somebody, some spam email going, oh, my God, you'll never be able to take another vitamin again if the FDA has its way. That is sky is falling stuff that's not true.
Right. You're not going to have the FDA knocking at your door tomorrow if you tell your friend to drink chicken soup because they have a cold.
Right.
But any regulation any statement, any policy statement, even if it's a statement of existing policy, can have an implication for the way Congress will view existing legislation or potential legislation down the line. And our concern with this document is pretty simple. First of all, it solicited comments on it after it was already issued, when we felt that the FDA should have been soliciting comments on the proposed document before actually issuing it.
Sure.
Secondly, it creates a state of regulatory confusion regarding the agency's authority and what could be considered a complementary and alternative medicine product.
So just in 10 seconds here, what should people say or do?
People should ask them to withdraw the guidance, to solicit further public comment, to reissue the guidance, but to continue to protect their access to supplements and nutrients as food, not as drugs.
Great. Okay, well said. Frank Hurd, he's the executive director of Citizens for Health, the website citizens, with an S at the end, .org. Frank, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Tom.
45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Your phone call's next. I hope you're not talking to CBS, NBC, or ABC, or CNN, Fox, or MSNBC, other than perhaps Keith Olbermann, because you ain't going to get it. 9.5 minutes before the hour, but you will hear. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. David in Long Beach, California, listening to us on K-Talk. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
I wanted to just go over quickly. I had met you at the Winter Brain Conference a couple of years ago, and we've done some great gains with regards to using neurofeedback and other approaches for depression. A lot of the emphasis is so much on taking a pill or a capsule, whether it be pharmaceutical or over the counter. And what really gets neglected is other approaches that work as better, as good or as better. And doing neurofeedback, with people with depression, even severe depression, usually gives pretty good results. There's another approach that we've been using called grief recovery. And one of the amazing things about this is that the symptoms of depression are exactly the same symptoms of unresolved grief. And it's pretty amazing how the approaches are real similar as far as getting resolved.
Yeah, that's great, David. I'm a big fan of neurofeedback. Neurofeedback is where you measure somebody's brain activity and feed it back to them in a way that allows them to start taking control of or strengthening parts of their brain that do things that need to be done, as opposed to things that you just assume weren't being done. Bill in Queens, New York. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Listening
before We were talking about, you were talking about Cindy Sheehan's resignation from the anti-war movement. But, you know, the day before she issued that statement, she, as you well know, she issued a statement resigning from the Democratic Party. And in part it was because she received such vitriol attacks from Democratic Party activists that she then resigned from the movement in general. Now, even though you say that this is not a Democratic-owned war, Cindy Sheehan had come to that conclusion. She said, now, based on Democratic inaction and complicity in the Congress, this is a war that is equally owned by the Democrats. And I think that anybody who doubts the Democrats' long-term aggressive intentions toward Iraq should recall that during the Clinton-Gore regime, 500,000 Iraqi children died as a result of that sanction regime. That, I mean, that's pretty close to the results that George Bush has achieved. And and the Democrats now, you know, they even in their strongest early bills, they never called for complete withdrawal. They called for withdrawal of combat troops, which would leave 80,000 so-called anti-terrorist troops, 100,000 plus private contractors. They one of their benchmarks was the TSA agreement that would steal Iraqi oil. They share all the basic geopolitical objectives of the Republicans on this. They differ only in tactics. And the Democratic Party, what's the real Democratic Party?
Just stop for just a second, Bill.
Okay.
The they that you're talking about is not a monolithic entity. There are many Democrats. There are many Democrats who do not share those goals.
Yeah, but they don't control the party. The DLC, which you say is a faction, they control the big money that controls the party. And that's the reality.
At the moment.
This is not the Democratic Party.
No, I don't disagree with you. And it's one of the reasons why I think that, that activists and progressives need to get out there and get inside the Democratic Party and take it over from within rather than standing on the outside going, oh, it's terrible, it's terrible, we're leaving. Where are you going to go? Well, we'll take over the Republican Party. Sorry. The corporations already have that. They've got half of the Democratic Party and all of the Republican Party. It's time for us to take it back. But your point is well taken. Rebecca in Edmonds, Washington, listening on K-Talk, KPTK in Seattle. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi. Hey, Tom, you've been talking about cracking the code.
Yeah.
Well, I represent about an organization that has about 20,000 members. It's called Washington for Impeachment. And last night we had a steering committee meeting, and one of our members, Libby Carr, came up with a really good frame. And I think it's really, we really need to educate our members of Congress. I think it might make a difference. And here it is. Okay, when we talk about impeaching Bush and Cheney, they give us lots of excuses. They say, oh, but then if we impeach Bush, we'd have Cheney, or we don't have the votes, or it would distract from more important work, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, those are issues. And like passing minimum wage, passing health care, passing immigration, but those are issues. The Constitution is not an issue. And they put it on the list as if it's another issue. Impeachment? Well, can't get to that. We've got to do this. We've got to educate our members of Congress as well as the public that we can separate, we have to separate this. This is like the foundation of our house, this Constitution. It's not just another issue, and that's the and so we're going to have, and I'd like for everybody to go to WashingtonForImpeachment.org if they would, and see what we're doing on June 24th in Seattle. We're going to have a very exciting forum with Elizabeth de la Vega, David Lindorf, Phil Burke, and we were hoping maybe you, but I don't know if you're available, but we're going to invite you anyway. But we're going to be at Seattle U. We have room for about 450 people, Piggott Auditorium. And we really want to help people understand that the Constitution is really at risk here.
It really and truly is, and I wish you well with it, Diane. Just like with the voting, I was having this conversation with Rob Call over at Op-Ed News yesterday, and we were talking about the voting machines, and he said that you know, Rush Holt is bringing in computer consultants about his legislation to, you know, to regulate voting machines and things, and I'm like, he doesn't need computer consultants. He needs democracy consultants. He needs constitutional consultants. I mean, why are we turning our democracy over to private for-profit corporations in this case, in the context of voting machines? Why are we turning our military over to private for-profit corporations in the context of all the privatization and everything that the Bush regime is doing over in Iraq? I mean, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on. We need to be talking, good point, absolutely good point. We need to be talking about the Constitution. We need to be talking about the values upon which this country was founded, about the what this country is grounded in. We need to be taking back our country. Tomorrow, I'm going to be debating a conservative about Bush's National Security Presidential Directives 51 and 20. Liz Holtzman is here on the impeachment of George W. Bush, a practical guide for concerned citizens. Harvey Wasserman about Solartopia, green powered earth, 80-20-30. And as always, the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.